You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
So this is when we begin to enter the talk show format of the conference, just to change things up. But I did want to express my thanks to Todd too for his presentation at lunch. I thought it was fantastic, fascinating, and taught me a lot, and it was a great compliment to some of the issues that we've been talking about today. So we've covered a lot of ground looking at Myanmar's economy and development priorities and looking at Myanmar's future from kind of Tokyo and Washington and how each country is approaching these development challenges and political transition challenges. And then looking at it kind of from through the eyes of Burma and Myanmar itself. And another key component of all this is the rest of the region or the rest of the world that is a part of this this process and this experiment in many regards, and that's what we wanted to take a little bit of time in this third session. And excuse me. Oh, so I'm supposed to make an announcement that phone. Please turn off phones so we don't run interference on the microphones and also. Interrupt the discussion. So obviously we can't have the entire region at our disposal, but we have a nice cross section and a chance to foster discussion on how other countries that have a stake in Myanmar's future and are contributing in a variety of ways, both to support Myanmar but also to maximize their national interests. And we wanted to have a chance to hear some different approaches and priorities, concerns, and thoughts about how the United States is approaching things or Japan's approach as well. And whether they concur wholeheartedly or have slightly different issues in terms of some of this discussion of synergy and how policy is coordinated. We don't have purely ASEAN here, but we have some of ASEAN here, and I'm curious about their thoughts about support for Myanmar, given ASEAN was really a leader in the 1990s with the idea of its constructive engagement policy, and that has laid some of the groundwork for where we are today. One final introductory note. I touched upon this a little bit earlier in the question about China and U.S. and Japan motivations for working in support of Myanmar. But I really do believe that Asia is in its formative years of development right now. As far as it's come, these are some critical years, and this experiment, this process going on in Myanmar is an opportunity that could be a real unifying force in that regard. So with us today, to my left, we have Ms. Clara Koh from the Singapore Embassy. She's First Secretary of the Political Section there, and will lead us off. We also have, to her left, Prasanth Paramasawan, who's a doctoral candidate at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, and not just someone who knows about Malaysia but quite broadly in the region, and so I'm glad you're able to join us here today. And to his left, Hamish McDonald, who's now here in Washington at the Woodrow Wilson Center as a public policy scholar in the Asia program, had been a former Asia-Pacific editor for the Sydney Morning Herald, and has lived throughout Southeast Asia and other parts of Asia, and can help us understand not only the view from Canberra and Australia, but other parts of Asia as well. So to begin, I'd really just like to ask each of our panelists to open up with a few comments about their perspective or their country's perspective in terms of national interest and policy approach vis-a-vis Myanmar going forward, and then foster a little discussion here before we turn it open to the group more broadly. Claire, can I begin with you? Sure. We have time.
Okay, we do. Well, thank you, Jim. I think before I begin, I thought I would give a caveat. As many of you in the audience know, being, you know, a diplomat, you're often put in situations where you have to talk about issues that you're not really, you know, the best expert on. And I'm here, you know, I see Professor David Steinberg in the audience, and I feel like I'm really in this one of these situations. But I'm, you know, really happy to be here. We're not able to rustle up a Myanmar expert from the embassy to come here and speak to you to share Singapore's perspective on Myanmar's challenges and the way forward. But we thought it was an important and timely enough discussion that we should sort of share our thoughts the best we can. And so I'll try to do my best here today in that regard. Before I go into you know, the main meat of my presentation, I thought, you know, I would set out some context to how Singapore has approached our engagement to Myanmar, which is, I guess, similar to ASEAN, as you mentioned, a sort of a constructive engagement approach. As some of you know, Singapore has had long-standing relations with Myanmar. I think even before, you know, you saw the political transition, and now under President Thein Sein, you know, Singapore pursued a pro-engagement approach to Myanmar. And, you know, in our opinion, we believe that, you know, engagement was a far better incentive for positive change within Myanmar than isolation. And we also believe that having Myanmar within ASEAN afforded more regional stability than having Myanmar outside of ASEAN. So I think the utility of this approach really became evident in the aftermath of Cyclone Nargis in 2008. And as many of you might recall here, it was really large-scale devastation, loss of human life, probably the worst natural disaster ever to have hit, you know, Myanmar. And so the government of Myanmar mobilized very quickly to respond to the disaster, but, you know, the scale and the urgency of the humanitarian needs were really overwhelming. And at the time, you know, there was some wariness on the part of the government to allow international relief and supplies to come in. And so I remember very vividly, Singapore was the ASEAN chair at the time, and so we convened a special ASEAN foreign ministers meeting. ASEAN came together to support one of our own, and also we stepped in what we thought was a way to broker trust between the government then and the international community. We formed this creative mechanism, which we called the Tripartite Core Group, which had representatives from the Myanmar government, ASEAN, as well as United Nations, to find a way to facilitate and, you know, enhance the flow of humanitarian assistance and workers into Myanmar to kind of meet the great humanitarian needs. So, you know, I remember this because I was just, you know, I just joined the foreign ministry literally a few days after the cyclone hit Myanmar, and so, you know, I wasn't covering Myanmar, but it was really all hands on deck. We all were thrown into all of this to set up the ASEAN meeting. And, you know, I remember having the thought at the time that, you know, Myanmar's experience of working with the international community during this relief and the longer-term recovery phase of the, you know, disaster was a taste of international goodwill for the country and also the possibilities of opening up to the world. So now fast forward to where we are today, and obviously Myanmar is in a very different place. The president has very admirably steered the country towards a democratic transition over the last 2 years. His administration has demonstrated a commitment to reforms, socioeconomic development. The political landscape has also become a lot more vibrant. You know, all parties have their eyes on the 2015 general elections. Aung San Suu Kyi, you know, the parliamentary speaker, Sri Man, have declared their intentions to contest the presidency. And Myanmar has also demonstrated its desire to integrate into the international community. Some of you may recall last year, they very ably hosted the World Economic Forum in East Asia. In December, they were also host to the Southeast Asia Games. And all this, you know, is a sort of a preview to the big role that they are playing this year as ASEAN chair. And, you know, as you know, there are thousands of ASEAN meetings to host when you are the ASEAN chair. And in addition, you know, a couple of summits this year as well, including one with the U.S. president coming in, hopefully at the end of the year. So, you know, in turn, the international community has responded. We've had a whole day of discussion on what Japan and the U.S. have been doing, various forms of assistance to help Myanmar. Singapore, on our part, as I will get into now, has expanded our technical assistance to Myanmar to help with its what it hopes to achieve, you know, development-wise, its priorities, but also its regional aspirations, particularly as it chairs ASEAN this year. So very quickly, before I talk about what we're doing exactly in Myanmar, I thought I'd share a little bit about the Singapore's philosophy in terms of development assistance.
Before you jump into that, can I just remind, I'm told the feedback we're getting is probably from phones accessing the wireless network, because the mics are using the wireless network as well. So I just wanted to reiterate if anyone had their phone on, just to make sure we turn that off. Thank you. Sorry for that.
Okay. Our approach to development assistance. So unlike other countries, like, you know, Japan, Singapore does not provide financial assistance. We also don't do financing for things like infrastructure development. So our approach is different. We take, you know, draw from our own developmental experience, where we saw that, you know, human resource development, technical assistance is equally or if not more important in terms of creating the right conditions for development, sustainable growth for the long term. And obviously, you know, a country without, we always say this, as a small country without natural resources, apart from human resources, we put a great emphasis on that aspect. And so we've created, you know, what we call the Singapore Cooperation Program. And this is a platform where Singapore is able to give back to the international community through capacity building in areas that Singapore is strong, and that could range from port management, you know, public administration, water management, those kinds of things. And very specifically dealing with ASEAN, we have something that we call the Initiative for ASEAN Integration. And this is something that we've, you know, contributed about $170 million, started in 2000, focusing on human resource development for the CLMV countries. So, you know, I'll get to what we do in Myanmar under this rubric. And apart from that, we've also given out a lot of scholarships to young people from ASEAN to come to Singapore to study. And there are no obligations attached to these scholarships, with only the expectation that these young people, upon graduation, return home to their countries to participate in sort of the development of their countries. So now, what are we doing with Myanmar in particular? You know, to Singapore, to help Myanmar is something that's in our interest. There is certainly in helping Myanmar is part of our sort of larger goal of seeing a more integrated ASEAN. We see that a strong, you know, as an integrated ASEAN, both economically, socioeconomically, makes for a stronger ASEAN. We become more attractive to investment, more competitive to our much larger neighbors, and also allows us to tackle other regional challenges that we face. So under the Singapore Cooperation Program, we have trained about close to 10,000 Myanmar officials, things like public administration, trade facilitation, and healthcare. And this we've been doing long before the transition that we saw a few years ago. And now when the current president Tin-Sian visited Singapore in 2012, I think they found that the technical assistance that we've been giving to them has been very helpful. And we decided that we'd launch something else together, and we call it the Singapore-Myanmar Technical Cooperation Program. And this will be a platform that will provide even more targeted technical assistance to support Myanmar's development. Things like, you know, we talked about the importance of cities and planning, so we're doing things like urban planning with them. In terms of helping them to create more positive investment environment, we've worked with them, or we're working with them in sort of banking regulation, supervision, legal services, you know, things like the rule of law to give investors confidence to come into the Myanmar market. But yeah, in more concrete terms, we're also working with the Myanmar government to set up a vocational training institute in Yangon. This institute would help to, we hope, at least to grow a pool of skilled Myanmar workers who would in turn be able to support more investments, you know, higher skilled investments into Myanmar and support foreign investments. So we're running we're planning to run courses in things like electronics, engineering, hospitality, so, you know, touching on different sort of sectors of the economy where we think there is potential. And of course, as Myanmar takes on the ASEAN chair this year, we're doing a lot to offer very specific training. This we've been doing since 2002, really laying the ground for them taking up the role this year. So things like hospitality, media management. We've worked with USAID in terms of running courses on what does the ASEAN economic community mean to Myanmar. And because I think that's an important topic to talk about because in terms of, you know, what discussing with the Myanmar government, because we have within ASEAN our goal of reaching an economic community by 2015, and Myanmar's chairmanship, you know, is an important time to kind of work through and try to meet those targets. We have other platforms, working with Japan, working with the United States. This is what we call the third country training program. With the US, we started this again in 2012. And the idea is working with, you know, partners who share, you know, similar objectives that we have, to work in synergy. You know, we talked about synergy earlier today, same thing, where we have expertise, we can pool our resources, work together and better deliver technical assistance where we think there is need. So with the United States, for example, we've done joint training for note-taking is one of the things that we've done, very concrete sort of skill when ASEAN takes, when Myanmar takes over the ASEAN chair. Under the Japan-Singapore Partnership Program for the 21st Century, we have done different courses on occupational health and safety, intellectual property protection, trade facilitation, those kinds of things. So there's a lot of assistance flowing through to Myanmar at this stage. You know, we've heard a lot of generosity has been, people have opened their hearts and opened their sort of minds to Myanmar. And so our approach really, to summarize, is to help Myanmar develop software as opposed to the hardware. Through technical assistance, you know, to equip policymakers with tools to channel assistance through effective policies to meet their development priorities. And, you know, in so doing, Singapore consults very closely with the Myanmar government, other stakeholders, to better understand what is needed and also to identify ways where we can best contribute and also work with partners to do the same. And in all this, we don't sort of prescribe, you know, the particular Singapore development model or any particular Singapore way for development, but rather, and neither do we claim to have all the answers, but really is to work in partnership, see where there are needs, and to kind of try and fill that gap. So I guess we can elaborate a lot more later in the discussion.
Okay, good. No, thank you for getting us started. You want to do an equipment change?
Yeah.
Is it me or her?
It's her.
See if that improves it there. Sorry about that.
I take this off. Can I turn it? Okay.
One quick question I wanted to ask you about is just following up. I think that's. I think we're okay there. Before I move on to Prasanth, you mentioned the issue of capacity building in the area of financial services and legal services and some of those areas. Is there an ASEAN standard or ASEAN committees or kind of where that is done within a broader kind of regional standard? Or are you simply passing that along in the context of this is how we do it in Singapore, or is it tied to broader international standards? I wonder to what extent it's tied into some kind of existing framework or set of standards.
I think for now, what we're doing in terms of legal services is really on a bilateral basis. We kind of share our experience on how we do it. But at the back of our minds is also to think about what are the international standards for these kinds of things. So the New York Convention, I believe, is one of those standards in terms of, you know, international arbitration, which gives companies some sort of confidence when they come into a market to invest. And so we do have that at the back of our mind when we kind of, you know, engage with the Myanmar officials mm-hmm. in these types of things.
Thank you. Prasanth, let me turn to you and tell us a little bit about the view from Malaysia, and you can add your own editorializing as well.
Okay, great.
You have the benefit of not coming from an embassy necessarily.
Yeah, great. Thanks a lot, Jim, and also Vikram and the Carnegie Endowment for holding this conference and also inviting me. It's always nice while being a PhD candidate and writing your dissertation to sort of get away from that for a while and engage with policy issues as well, which I'm looking to do being outside the DC area. And so I'm here to basically provide basically Malaysia's perspective on both Myanmar and U.S.-Japan cooperation in Myanmar. But I should add a caveat, first of all. First of all, I don't represent an official perspective from Malaysia. And secondly, my primary expertise is in Southeast Asia, ASEAN, and U.S. policy in Southeast Asia. So I'm also not a, you know, a huge Myanmar expert, like many others here in the audience as well. So I will defer to them on the specifics of that. What I want to do is sort of divide my remarks into two parts. First of all, look at Malaysia's key interests in Myanmar. And then secondly, provide some preliminary thoughts as to the Malaysia's government's and Malaysia in general, its perspectives on U.S.-Japan cooperation in Myanmar as part of cooperation in ASEAN more generally. So I think it'd be useful to divide Malaysia's interest in Myanmar in terms of three prisms, in terms of how Malaysia has looked at Myanmar. So the first prism is sort of Myanmar as an economic partner and investment destination. And here, I guess the main reference point would be the sort of Joint Commission on Economics, Science, and Technology, which was signed in 17th of January on the sidelines of the ASEAN Foreign Ministers Retreat in Bagan. We originally had the Joint Commission when Prime Minister Najib visited Myanmar in March of 2012, but it was finally signed officially, which sort of gives more structure to Malaysia's relationship with Myanmar. In terms of the figures, Malaysia's bilateral trade with Myanmar is about $1 billion, and investment is around the same. So you have about 40 companies, Malaysian companies, operating in Myanmar, and about a third of that trade and investment is in oil and gas. So very much a primary area there. And if you think about corporations, the main one is Petronas, right, from Malaysia. Even Malaysian government officials and also businessmen from Myanmar, when they speak in institutions in Malaysia like, you know, ISIS in Malaysia, which is a major think tank, concede openly that Malaysia's trade in Myanmar is still quite small. And one of the Malaysian government's priorities, actually, over the past couple of years has been to encourage more business and trade between Malaysia and Myanmar. Some of the priority areas that the government is looking at are science and technology, a role for small and medium enterprises in Myanmar, which is also a major domestic goal in Malaysia, as well as continuing some of the major investments in sectors like oil palm and tourism and hospitality. The second part, so the first is an economic partner and investment destination. The second part is Malaysia's view of ASEAN as a fellow member of ASEAN, or Myanmar as a fellow member of ASEAN. And this is not just merely because of self-interest, as in, you know, Malaysia's invested in ASEAN and Myanmar is part of ASEAN, so we encourage ASEAN unity. It's not just merely a rhetorical device. Malaysia actually played a very constructive role in terms of getting Myanmar into ASEAN initially when it joined the organization in 1997. And so there is this feeling that Malaysia has a responsibility to ensure that Myanmar, as part of ASEAN, is a constructive member and actually continues to function as part of the organization. A more immediate goal is the fact that, you know, Myanmar has the chairmanship of ASEAN this year in 2014. Malaysia is going to have the chairmanship next year in 2015, which is a very critical year. So we have a vested interest as well in ensuring that Myanmar's chairmanship goes on very smoothly. And I would highlight two issues in particular. One is the role of the ASEAN economic community, which is coming to fruition now, I guess, December 31st, 2015. And although a lot of the work will be done with Malaysia in the concluding year, it's very much a joint process, and a lot of the work will also be done and is being done now by Myanmar in 2014. So that's one critical area. The second critical area is the South China Sea. As I'm sure many of you know, the sort of kerfuffle, to put it nicely, in Cambodia in 2012, Malaysia has an interest as a claimant state in the South China Sea to make sure that there's no similar issue that happens in 2014 with Myanmar. So far, all indications are that that's not going to happen. The ASEAN foreign ministers issued a statement on the South China Sea and the retreat in Bagan. And so I don't think that's significant concern as of now, but we'll have to see as we go through the major ASEAN summits later in the year to see if this is the case. The third aspect, and I think this is probably the most divisive aspect, but I can sort of speak about it a little bit more honestly because I'm not a representative of the embassy, is that Myanmar's role as an exporter of migrant labor to Malaysia. And this is actually an outgrowth of our former Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad's sort of vision to address labor shortages in Malaysia by bringing in workers from Myanmar. That's had positive impacts in the sense that, you know, we've addressed the labor shortage to a certain degree, but it has also had unintended effects. I mean, there's now, I think, about 300,000 Myanmar nationals in Malaysia. About 100,000 of those, I mean, obviously it's very difficult to determine how many of those are actually documented or not, but the estimates I've seen are, you know, in the upwards of 100,000 of these 300,000 are actually undocumented. When you go to the Myanmar embassy in Malaysia to get your visa, if you're visiting Myanmar, you'll see two lines. One is, you know, to get your official visa, and the other one is for Myanmar nationals who are trying to deal with their citizenship issue, and that line is huge, even if you start at 8 a.m. or 9 a.m. in the morning. Whereas the visa line is extremely small. And that is not just an existential concern or just sort of a visual sight of how many Myanmar nationals you see on the street. It's also manifested itself in ways that, from Malaysia's perspective, are not very conducive. So on February 20, you heard, some of you may have heard of sort of the assassination attempt on two visiting Myanmar officials who were coming to Malaysia. And it was basically a drive-by shooting attempt. They survived, fortunately. But these two individuals were supposedly members in Myanmar of sort of a very sort of nationalist Buddhist wing. And the perception among some people in Malaysia was that the individuals who targeted them were actually those who were more supportive of the Muslim community and opposed the sort of nationalist sentiment. This is very interesting because it's a case of sort of spillover of Myanmar's intercommunal violence into Malaysia. And Malaysian officials take it very seriously. This is not the first, or it's not an isolated incident. Last June, a similar incident happened. And you saw Malaysia caution Myanmar in quite clear language that they should get their act together on the intercommunal situation because it's not just an internal issue, because, you know, as you know, ASEAN has this whole idea of not interfering in the internal affairs of other states. But as Malaysia made very clear last year, when this sort of affects peace and stability in Malaysia, and also from Indonesia's perspective as well, as you saw with the embassy attacks, or the attempted embassy attacks, this is something that affects other countries in Southeast Asia as well. So that's worrisome. Let me just briefly talk about a few things from my own perspective about what Malaysia might think about U.S.-Japan support efforts or coordination efforts or synergies. I think Malaysia would view U.S.-Japan cooperation in Myanmar to the extent that it promotes, you know, peace, stability, prosperity, democracy as something that's extremely productive. And that's not just productive from Myanmar, but also ASEAN more broadly, as I said earlier. And Malaysia is one of the founding members of ASEAN and also inheriting the chair next year has a vested interest in that. I also think Malaysia recognizes and has long recognized the value of the U.S.-Japan alliance in terms of promoting peace, prosperity, and stability in the Asia-Pacific. And to the extent that that alliance is working in Southeast Asia and Myanmar productively, that's a good thing. That being said, I think there are a few challenges that this might sort of raise for both the U.S. and Japan going forward. And I think we've heard several speakers mention it already earlier this afternoon, so I can just briefly go through them. I think Professor Steinberg summed it up very well in terms of the differing role of human rights and democracy in terms of both U.S. and Japan. And I think if we move along into the 2015 elections and we see differences playing out, that might be a place where there might be some differences. I think from Malaysia's perspective, Malaysia has long been a vociferous opponent of some of the U.S. sanctions on Myanmar. It's sort of adopted a more sort of constructive engagement, pragmatic diplomacy, whatever you want to call it, an approach which says we should economically engage Myanmar while pushing for human rights and democracy, but we shouldn't be pushing human rights and democracy too much such that we're not assisting Myanmar in terms of developing its economy and society. Some of that is due to Malaysia's own economic self-interest, but I would argue part of that is also a broader concern for the welfare of the region and for Myanmar in particular. The second thing I would mention is also this idea, I think Professor Steinberg and others mentioned this as well, which is what China thinks about, you know, the U.S.-Japan alliance moving into Myanmar as a unit. And while, you know, that's, you know, what China feels is what China feels, and I guess, you know, the U.S. and Japan shouldn't take, shouldn't make their policies only based on the consideration of what the Chinese government thinks, I think it'd be very interesting from Malaysia's perspective, as a country which is also trying to balance various external actors like China, like Japan, like the U.S., to see how Myanmar manages this this tension between various powers potentially in the future. Lastly, I would just mention, and I think we got some of this in the keynote earlier, the problem with thinking about Myanmar in terms of an overly linear approach. I think it'd be much more useful to think about it in terms of scenarios. So it's all well and good to talk about how the U.S. and Japan cooperate in Myanmar when you're talking about, you know, economic development and, you know, things are going well relatively in terms of democracy and human rights. But what if you have, as Professor Steinberg and others have eloquently pointed out, a backlash in terms of anti-globalization? How are U.S. and Japan going to tackle that? Also, you know, maybe I'm thinking too far ahead, but there's also an upward scenario in a couple of years, which is Myanmar does overly too well, and what do other countries in the neighborhood, you know, such as Laos and Cambodia, think about a Myanmar which is, you know, they're not just assisting, but is becoming an economic competitor in several of its sectors, to the extent that it might undermine FDI and their own economies. So I think thinking in terms of, you know, not just the sort of status quo, but also sort of the upwards and the downward scenario will be something that would be interesting to think about. But I'll stop there.
Thank you very much. Quickly, before I go on to Hamish, I wanted to ask, because of my own ignorance, viewed from Malaysia, if you were to put it on a scale of 1 to 10, looking at Myanmar, how important or predominant is the religious issue and the tension and discrimination against Muslims in Myanmar? Is that a big issue from Malaysia's 7, 8, or 9, or is it on the lower scale? Where would you put it?
Yeah, so I actually wanted to initially talk in my remarks a little bit about the domestic context of Malaysia right now, but I took it out in the interest of time. But just very briefly, Malaysia's primary goal in the next few years is to become a developed country by 2020. I mean, we call it Wawasan 2020 in Malaysia. And that's the primary goal. So I think primarily the government would think about it economically. And although Myanmar is less than 1% of Malaysia's overall trade, it's still an important partner in terms of its overall engagement with ASEAN as well. And as I said, you know, strategic investments in oil and gas with important companies like Petronas. But the Muslim issue and the intercommunal violence that has spilled over into Malaysia is also an important issue, not just because it's a stability and security issue, but because Malaysia is also a member of several, it's a Muslim majority country, and it's also putting a lot of emphasis on the global movement for moderates, the OIC as well. So several Muslim bodies which Malaysia is part of, and actually there's been some domestic debate about whether Malaysia is sort of holding true to its Muslim identity by engaging Myanmar and not putting too much of an emphasis on this Muslim or intercommunal violence question. So I would say, you know, in sum, it's not the first or the highest priority issue, but I think it's definitely up there in terms of importance, particularly lately because it's, you know, it's actually undermined peace and stability in Malaysia, and actually in the Malaysian press, it's gotten a lot of coverage.
Thank you. Hamish, let me turn to you for both your thoughts from an Australian perspective, but feel free to sure. Weave in other thoughts from your time in the region.
Okay. Well, Australia is quite a long way from Burma, but Australians have been involved in Burma for 130 years or so. I think Australia's viewed Burma through different sets of spectacles at different times. The first set would have been an imperial British one when a number of Australians jumped into the development of Burma and took various roles there. There was the famous walk of the journalist G. Morrison from the Yangtze to the Irrawaddy in 1893. In the 20s, there was a character called Herbert Bellamy, who became the biggest bookie on the Rangoon racecourse, and he married a Burmese princess, the granddaughter of the last king, much to the dismay of the British judge who married them. He thought this was an example of even further decline for the Burmese aristocracy. The daughter of that marriage, incidentally, a half-Australian lady, became the fourth wife of General Ne Win in the late 70s, and that marriage lasted about 3 months until an ashtray was thrown by the president towards her head and she departed town. Now, I don't know what that tells us in vis-a-vis the Steinberg-Sefkin exchange about the position of Burmese women this morning, but there are obviously limits of tolerance. After I read about her in Tan Myint U's first book, I did actually track her down a couple of years ago in Italy, where she lives now, and she's still a very feisty 80-year-old, and I can imagine either a Burmese or a Western husband might find her at times a bit difficult. I think the next set of... Australia avoided most of the fighting in Burma in World War II. Churchill tried to divert our troops from the Middle East to try and stop the Japanese invasion in early 1942, but our Prime Minister brought them back to fight in New Guinea eventually. So apart from the soldiers, the POWs on the Burma Railroad from Thailand, there was no major involvement in the Second World War. The next set of spectacles were a Cold War counterinsurgency type of view of Southeast Asia in the 50s and 60s, when Australia probably welcomed Ne Win's takeover as bolstering the anti-communist backbone of Southeast Asia. Ne Win was reasonably acceptable for many years in Canberra. He made his last visit there in 1974 as a guest of Gough Whitlam, a famous Labor Prime Minister. It was really only in the 1980s when the rest of Southeast Asia began to industrialize very rapidly and Burma lagged behind and became quite a case of neglect and underdevelopment that distance developed. And then, of course, the events of 1988 to 1990 brought the shutters down and a limited number of sanctions were applied, a ban on sales of military equipment and services to the Burmese military. But without any great Australian interest in economic prospects or investment in Burma and no trade, even now trade is only about $100 million a year bilaterally, it became a bit of a niche human rights issue, a subject for indignation by a few backbenchers in our parliaments, book club discussion and so on, but not a great central issue for us. It was off our beaten track. That changed after Myanmar was brought into ASEAN in 1997. And then by that stage, we put on our third set of spectacles, which was a very ASEAN-focused view of Southeast Asia. A very conscious decision that ASEAN was the core region, a regional grouping for our immediate region to the north, and one that we had to foster, encourage, and gently try to shepherd in the right direction. Myanmar looked at that stage for some years like not being a very positive addition to ASEAN, that as it developed, it latterly it was overwhelmed by Chinese investment and migration and projects. It potentially added to a kind of dead weight of countries like Laos and Cambodia and even Thailand, who might drift away to a more China-centric position in the region. Problems that persist, and as just mentioned, with that ASEAN conference in Cambodia in 2012. So, and then a number of other rather negative developments, such as the military connection with North Korea and mysterious excavations by North Korean engineers, some attention by Tan Shui's government to developing a small nuclear reactor, sending technicians to Russia to learn how to run it, and so on. It all looked a little bit alarming. So it was with great relief that the great switch occurred in 2011 with the president's overtures to Aung San Suu Kyi, her decision to enter the political sphere, the suspension of the Mitsunai, the dam project on the Upper Irrawaddy, and Australia, like other countries, including the United States, decided to put weight behind that. In terms of the ASEAN connection, we also discovered a useful instrument which we wanted to encourage, which was that whereas the regime, the former military regime, was still working to a model, a political model, very closely, very similar to the formula applied in Indonesia in the 1970s, when the Suharto government decided it had to move from a pure military regime to something that looked essentially similar but still remained under control. It adopted the formula of a parliament stacked with presidential nominations, a block of military representation, and a bureaucratic military political vehicle, very similar to Indonesia's Golkar Party under the Suharto New Order. But by the time Tan Shui decided to apply the roadmap, so-called roadmap to democracy that had been worked out some years before in the first decade of this century, Indonesia had moved significantly away from that model, and after the reforms between 1998 and 2004, it had become one of the standard bearers of a new democracy within the ASEAN group. So Australia encouraged efforts by the new face of Indonesia to tell the Burmese not to go down that road, that this so-called roadmap led to a dead end and more political turmoil. So to the extent that Australia had influence, it encouraged Indonesia to get involved with the Burmese, particularly with the military, and try to steer them towards a more open political system. Now, how influential that was, We don't know at this point, but certainly since 2011, there have been a lot of Australian involvement alongside the Indonesians to press the point that the current system is not a formula that's going to last, that they have to look to removing the military veto on constitutional change through the 25% representation and the 75% vote, also to remove the barrier to Aung San Suu Kyi in particular to running as a presidential candidate. Australia has been optimistic enough to lift the sanctions that were imposed in the latter days of Tan Shui's rule, which were targeted sanctions listing several hundred military figures, the so-called crony businessmen and family members, from operating bank accounts or sending their kids to universities and schools. They were all lifted in mid-2012. There still remains a military sales and services embargo, but Australia has about to send a military attaché to Rangoon to open military-to-military contacts. So there is judicious prodding still going on. The big question will come with the elections next year and the constitutional changes that the NLD is now pressing for. But as someone who observed the by-elections in April 2012, the signs so far are good. Particularly the assurance to the military that it's okay to let go is going to be very important, and it won't be us that they will listen to, us Australians, it will be more the ASEANs, and in particular I should think the Indonesians who are more likely to have some influence on that score. As I mentioned, our trade is not large. Our aid program is quite small, about $60 million, and focused on primary education and basic health. But in terms of the cooperative prospects for a joint aid approach to Myanmar, I think Australia would be a useful participant, both in terms of the skills we could bring in professional and management training and possibly drafting of new laws and regulations in sectors like mining and perhaps some other areas where we might have something to offer. I'll leave it there. I could talk if you like.
No, thank you very much, Hamish. That was very comprehensive, and it leads me to kind of two main questions that I'd like to ask before I open it up. First, with a little bit of a focus on the ASEAN side of things, because if I look at this from an ASEAN perspective, I might be tempted to feel that this great game kind of now that's developing vis-a-vis Myanmar and all the attention and the money that's coming in from Japan and the higher level attention in Washington than it used to get is too much too soon and is threatening to kind of overshadow ASEAN's role and in shepherding Myanmar to be a good ASEAN citizen, and is there concern at all in that regard, or a sense that ASEAN is losing some degree of control in Myanmar's development?
I guess I'll go first. I think ASEAN, you know, has been a partner of Myanmar. I wouldn't say in any way that we're trying to sort of steer Myanmar's development in any direction. I think the government of Myanmar pretty much is in the driver's seat. They know what, you know, they need. And working with our various international partners, including ASEAN, to kind of make the steps forward in terms of their development priorities, regional aspirations, those kinds of things.
Yeah, I mean, I'd echo that. I mean, I definitely agree that this is up to Myanmar to decide. I think I would say two additional things, though. So going to Myanmar last year, I was struck by how many times I heard, and, you know, this is written in the press as well, how much time Myanmar officials spend receiving foreign visitors, which may get in the way of their focus in terms of actually implementing some of the reforms that they originally thought of or conceived of. So I definitely think that efforts like this in terms of coordinating and attempts to find synergy between U.S. and Japan and other partners would be effective in that regard to the extent that it might streamline some of these various approaches. And I think the second thing I would say is in terms of sort of the too much too soon process is that I think from Malaysia's perspective, not just in terms of the U.S. or Japan's interests, but from our own perspective, we, through events like this intercommunal violence, which spills over periodically into Malaysia, we definitely recognize the fact that it's important to engage not only Myanmar as a country in terms of its government, but also the society and the broader populace, even though we're talking about minorities as opposed to majority. So I think a holistic approach is really important in that regard.
Right. So. Although you mentioned, and you mentioned this possibility that down the line there could be an element of if Myanmar is particularly successful, there's this element of competition within ASEAN. And I guess I would think if we look back at some of the discussions this morning in terms of Japan's investment and the number of Japanese companies coming in, that is there a potential zero-sum view in the private sector of which country has more entree or more I don't mean in the context of steering Myanmar necessarily in one direction or another, but if you have 40 Malaysian companies, but 170 or so Japanese companies, and at what point does the competition begin to come into friction with cooperation? Because clearly, everyone is benefiting from the capacity building initiatives that are going on, from the infrastructure development that is going forward. Should there be a more multilateral approach in the sense that utilizing Asian Development Bank, World Bank, and ASEAN mechanisms of coordination is some kind of official movement warranted, or is that potentially more bureaucratic and more problematic? And no, frankly, the current manner of coordination between large countries and through forums in the region is sufficient.
You could see something like the old intergovernmental group on Indonesia emerging, which included the World Bank, ADB, IMF, and probably a dozen donors, mostly Western plus Japan at that point. It's defunct now, but that kind of coordinating body, a regular thing, which might include China as well, if they'd agree, could be a way of, you know, avoiding overlap and duplication and everyone trying to do the same showy kind of stuff, and addressing sort of basic problems like health, social indicators, and infant mortality, all that kind of stuff that's crucially needed. That possibly is emerging already, but that would be a useful approach. The Chinese have not been willing to coordinate their aid very much in other parts of the world. Australia's tried for a long time to get them to do that in the South Pacific, in places like Papua New Guinea and Fiji. But it's worth pushing, it's worth pressing, and maybe that this kind of formula might be the way to avoid that kind of, or to improve the kind of Klondike atmosphere that's happening in Rangoon at the moment, with all kinds of chances coming in with wild and wonderful schemes and people pushing rents up to 10,000 a month for apartments, as Min U mentioned, and just, you know, calming it down and getting it heading in a more, you know, longer-term perspective.
Yeah. Well, I want to give the audience a chance to weigh in with their questions. So please just raise your hand, and we'll have a microphone delivered there. I have a question here.
Hi, thank you very much for your presentation. I have a question for the panel. Regarding South China Sea issue, what specific results you want Myanmar to achieve for his chairmanship in this year? Do you think ASEAN is ready for the joint development regarding the South China Sea issue? If Singapore and Malaysia is going to move forward or push for the idea of a joint development in the coming years? Thank you very much.
Do you want to tackle that?
Sure.
So I think two parts to that question, I guess. First is results that countries would like to see from Myanmar and South China Sea, and then second, are the countries ready for joint development? I think on the first count, I think at the minimum, what Malaysia and I think other claimants will be hoping for is no further regression on the South China Sea issue. Unlike what happened in Cambodia in 2012, so basically making sure that the South China Sea issue is on high visibility throughout the year in the major ASEAN summits and in other ASEAN fora. And I think the ASEAN Foreign Ministers Summit in Bagan was a good example of that in terms of the focus on the statement, specifically on the South China Sea issue. And I think the second thing, obviously, which I'm sure many of you already know, is making sure that we arrive not just at, you know, talking about a potential code of conduct in the South China Sea, but that is done in an expedited fashion. Not only that it's done in an expedited fashion, but the fact that the content of the code of conduct in the South China Sea needs to be serious in terms of a coordination of the network of hotlines between various countries, and in terms of addressing some of the major issues in terms of what happens in a crisis if ships come to conflict in the sea. With respect to whether countries are ready for joint development, my own personal view is that while this is the, some would say, only solution in the long term, in terms of how to share resources in the South China Sea, I find it very difficult to see how this will happen, considering that, to put it bluntly, the claimants can't even agree on what is being disagreed upon. It's not very clear exactly how the claims are actually delineated in terms of, if you look at specific maps. And it's very difficult for that to happen also when China is claiming about 90% of the entire South China Sea. In order for joint development to occur, one needs to make sure that each other respects what is being claimed and each other's claims. And I don't think that's happened. And as long as that doesn't happen, I find it very hard to see how joint development can happen.
Do you have something you want to add?
Yeah. I think I'll share our perspective. First of all, to be clear, Singapore is not among the claimants, among the ASEAN claimant states involved in the, you know, disputes in the South China Sea. And what we hope to work with Myanmar, as we have with previous ASEAN chairs, is really to reiterate those principles that ASEAN has already agreed to, six-point principles. And, you know, I don't have to repeat what those principles are, but in broad terms, it means that looking toward, you know, peaceful resolution of disputes in accordance with international law, and that includes the law of the sea. So really to be able to sort of keep, you know, the focus on and the unity of ASEAN, basically, on the issue of South China Sea. And, of course, as Prashant said, we also want to see, you know, progress on the code of conduct. We've already started discussions. I think there's a meeting that's scheduled, you know, in March. We're sitting down together with China to talk about the code of conduct. And, you know, we hope to see some movement into that. In terms of, we know that in our experience, at least Singapore and with our neighboring countries, we've had disputes, you know, in our waters. And taking these to international arbitration has taken decades to resolve. And you know, between Malaysia and Singapore, for example, the rocks, Petra Branca, there are no natural resources. There are no real fish there to catch. So you compare that, took us three decades to resolve that, how it's going to resolve in South China Sea, where sometimes it's more than just two countries sort of disputing a group of islands. So the goal then of the Code of Conduct, as Prashant says, is really to set some sort of rules of engagement. How do we sort of, in the meantime, as we hopefully start dealing with the disputes, how do we deal with each other, whether it's joint development, how do we, you know, the fishing fleets from various countries, how do we manage when they meet in areas that are deemed to be in dispute, and do it in a way that reduces tensions and reduces the chance for any sort of misunderstanding that could escalate into something potentially much worse. So I think these are the kinds of things that we hope to work with Myanmar in terms of making progress on for the chairmanship this year.
Thank you. I have a question here, and then I'll go over to that gentleman.
Hi, Jim Michael again. I have a very uninformed question. It just strikes me that there are some regional groupings that have standards in subject members to peer reviews with respect to issues such as human rights or economic policies. And I wonder if this is something that has come up in the ASEAN context, so that rather than singling out a particular country and, you know, putting it under the microscope and treating it differently, it would simply be that as part of a regional grouping, they would be subjected to similar reviews that other countries in that grouping have accepted as a part of being members of the group. Is there anything like that, either in existence or on its way to becoming a part of the ASEAN way of doing business?
Thank you. And while you think about fielding that one, I'll take one more question, and we'll put them together here as well.
Well, I'm not sure this continues from the last, but first a comment, because Myanmar is the chair of ASEAN this year. It would think that necessarily there would be much more contact, because I've been there recently, and there's concern about actually the venues for the various meetings that will take place during the year. But the question I wanted to ask is somewhat different. It has to do with some of the Burmese political scientists recently going to Indonesia, because their constitution was based on the original Indonesian constitution with the 25% military. So I wondered, how did Indonesia move beyond that military-focused constitution?
So let me go to the first question. Does anyone want to address the question about kind of multilateral standard application?
Well, I'm not aware of any sort of, a peer review system within ASEAN. You know, we've continued to keep to this principle of non-intervention, you know, in internal affairs. We have, you know, even in we've established an ASEAN Human Rights Commission, and a lot of that is really just discussing issues, not in a way that kind of puts someone, you know, in a spot, but let's kind of, this is an issue that we're dealing with, and how can we sort of tackle that type of issue? So, I mean,
kind of a support group?
Maybe. But, I mean, these discussions are happening, you know, and there are various sort of groups that are being formed within ASEAN to deal with social issues. So human trafficking is another issue that we're dealing with, law enforcement, transboundary sort of law enforcement issues. And I think these things are happening, discussions are happening. I think we just go about it in a different, you know, way in terms of dealing with potentially, you know, sensitive issues.
And I would think you'd have more success starting in that framework on drier, less sensitive issues and legal legal affairs, banking, other kinds of international regulation. Obviously, ASEAN deals with it on the customs side and on the trade side. But I think learning to become a part of that, of a broader framework that's not just one country telling you or a couple of countries telling you what to do is certainly a way of easing into that and then eventually subscribing to a wider range. Any other comments on that question? Or?
Yeah, well, I would say ASEAN has moved tentatively into setting human rights standards in from a position where, you know, non-interference in each other's affairs was the norm, and the government shied away from any stance on whatever abuse was happening across the border. It's something ASEAN has grappled with in the last few years, and the convention that they have adopted is a fairly timid one, I suppose you could say, but it's a step in that direction. And of course, you now have a lot of civil society groups in the ASEAN countries who do look across borders and use whatever freedom of comment they have and express it. So it's not just governments, but also societies that are mutually reinforcing human rights standards and raising questions. Some negatively. I mean, the Muslim groups in Indonesia are up in arms about the treatment of the Rohingyas, and we had that bombing case at the Jakarta embassy of Myanmar, or bombing attempt. So it's a fluid and varied area, but it is happening.
And what about the other gentleman's question on Indonesia constitutional model and
well, it really is a model of how it's an example of how the model worked out by the Burmese military in Indonesia ended in a crash, a convulsion when the system fell apart, and people picked up elements of it and modified them and introduced electoral competition, and the military happily abandoned its place in its allotted seats in the parliament, and stepped out of that direct involvement. It took a huge crisis for that to happen, but it did. But the pressure cooker was building up for many years before that.
I think we have time for one last question if anyone would like to press it, but we can also conclude it here and give ourselves
one point about, you know, ASEAN and what role perhaps it can play in terms of not really a coordinating role for assistance that's coming in. I think, you know, some of that is happening in terms of the ASEAN Master Plan for Connectivity. We think about, you know, approaching development in like the CLMV countries and, you know, elsewhere, building infrastructure, both hard infrastructure as well as soft infrastructure. You know, we've come up with this master plan, you know, that the Secretariat helps to administer, and it is kind of maps out quite broadly where are the areas of need, what is under construction, where, you know, we need sort of extra funding, areas that need to be developed. So there are, you know, these efforts in this way that kind of will map out our pathway towards being an integrated, you know, community eventually. So I think that's one of the roles that we are playing in that regard.
Thank you. Any other comments from the panel? Well, I appreciate giving us your time and your perspectives, and we will we'll take a short break. I think just about 10 minutes here. And we'll actually reconvene a few minutes early because I want to make sure we leave enough time for the final session. We have four great panelists for this final session, and then we conclude with a reception and a chance to really do some networking over wine and food as well. So you will be rewarded for hanging in there with us throughout this day. But please join me in thanking our panel for adding this important discussion.